They built a blast furnace here along the shore, and they made the cannonballs that helped the Union win the war. Here in Youngstown, here in Youngstown, my sweet Jane.
A few steelworkers who once worked at Warren's blast furnace gathered this morning to watch it come down.
40 years ago, this coming Tuesday marks the beginning of the end of the steel dominating the Youngstown area's economy.
There are no longer smokestacks, and much of it is covered by vegetation.
Okay.
How you doing?
I'm okay. How are you doing?
It's depressing getting down here, to be honest with you. You can't talk about the Mahoning Valley and not talk about the steel and manufacturing.
Them smokestacks reaching like the arms of God do.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor It Did Happen Here, Nothing is Final, discussion with Eric Ward and Scott Nakagawa on Thursday, March 4th from 6 to 8 p.m. This Zoom conversation is hosted by the Multnomah County Library. You can sign up for the event at the Multnomah County Library website under the events calendar for Thursday, March 4th. Scott Nakagawa and Eric Ward were interviewed for It Did Happen Here, the podcast about fighting neo-Nazis in Portland in the late 80s and early 90s. They'll talk about the work they did with the Coalition for Human Dignity and where the fight against white nationalists stands today. Again, that's It Did Happen Here, Nothing is Final. Registration happens on the Multnomah County Library website on their events calendar for Thursday, March 4th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And we'll never rest again until every Nazi dies.
Hello and welcome to the Bike Show, coming to you from Portland, Oregon. My name is Alon Robb. I hope you and your loved ones are well, and thank you for joining us today. Among the many challenges that the COVID-19 pandemic has presented to the health, livelihood, and well-being of individuals and communities, transportation is a major one. How to get to work, to food stores, medical facilities, how to get around while being safe. Amidst the despair and suffering of the past year, there have also been areas of light, and among them, the growing awareness of the bicycle as an essential means of transportation, exercise, physical and mental well-being, escape from a sense of closure and from stress, and a means of individual and societal transformation. In cities, towns, and villages all over the globe, cycling has gained new fans and devotees. There is a boom in the sales of both new and used bicycles, with many stores and bike shops having low inventory or no merchandise at all. Many people are also dusting off and lubricating that bicycle that has been languishing in a corner of the home or garage for too long. This increase in bicycle use has been met by many municipalities. They have been adding lanes, closing streets to car traffic, and installing places to lock bikes safely. Today's show is about the various uses of our favorite mode of transportation during this difficult time. We will start with a report by Michelle E. Porter about how essential workers who cycled to work were affected by the pandemic. Michelle's report will be followed by an interview with Eric Showell, Program Director of World Bicycle Relief, who will speak to us from his home in Cape Town, South Africa, an organization that since 2005 has been providing bicycles to school children, tree planters, and healthcare workers in several African countries. Bicycles are currently used by men and women in Zambia, Malawi, and Kenya as they deliver medicines and vaccines. After the interview with Eric Showell of World Bicycle Relief, we will listen to another segment by Michelle E. Porter about how bike businesses in Portland are doing. Before we delve into the subject of cycling during the pandemic and creative responses to the difficult situation, a few news items from the world of cycling. Today's news items are both from Portland, Oregon. A new pedestrian and bicycle bridge over I-405 at Northwest Flanders Street opened. The bridge connects the Northwest District and the Pearl District with safer and more comfortable crossing over I-405. Almost since the construction of the freeway in 1969, the area, called Old Town before gentrification, needed a safe path for pedestrians and cyclists. The existing crossings were congested, lacked pedestrian and bicycle facilities, and were located in the midst of a busy freeway ramp network. In 2007, the City of Portland identified Northwest Flanders Street as a biking and walking corridor, as well as an alternate seismic resilient route for emergency vehicles. During construction, the Bureau of Transportation had to fend off attempts by the Hyatt Place and Allison Residence planned 23-story hotel and residential tower to locate valet parking and loading zones on Northwest Flanders, which would have made cycling dangerous. A group called Pearl Neighbors for Integrity and Design, whose stated mission is fighting vertical sprawl, fought this plan and won. Flanders Crossing is an important part of the Flanders Bike Boulevard, first promised by city officials 15 years ago. The goal is to create a low-stress east-west connection between the Willamette River and Northwest 24th Avenue, where cyclists, pedestrians, and other non-motorized travelers have priority. The 24-feet-wide bridge adds a measure of safety and ease. It is expected to carry 9,000 crossings daily. In less happy news, despite having less traffic on the roads, 2020 saw a record level of traffic deaths and a big rise in reckless driving. In January, a driver in southeast Portland plowed into a crowd, murdering Jean Gerish and injuring 10 others, 5 seriously. Other incidences of road violence, often directed at cyclists, have also occurred. As Jonathan Ma, editor and publisher of the BikePortland.org publication, has written, the underlying issues that lead to these tragedies are all too familiar. Ma writes, the man who drove that silver Honda SUV didn't kill, injure, and frighten, quote, pedestrians and, quote, cyclists. He did this to Portlanders, people with names and families and friends who should never be minimized to a convenient and narrow label so others could file it away as something that doesn't impact them. Some call what happened a, quote, an accident. It wasn't, writes Ma. Many others are shocked, but it is not an aberration, nor should it come as a surprise, and this behavior will continue until we all understand and embrace our role in what caused it, then do the work it takes to change. The suspect's actions are a natural evolution of a culture that doesn't value human life on either side of the windshield and thinks it's acceptable to act like you don't. Large steel vehicles and people inside them, imbued with a feeling of invincibility, fueled by a pervasive culture of selfishness and speed, mixed with a systemic acceptance of its consequences. Jonathan Ma goes on to write, our enforcement policies need to be better at flagging high-risk drivers. Our mental and public health services need to find at-risk people and give them more support. Our transportation agencies need to fortify our streets by adding more concrete and protected spaces wherever and whenever possible. Our community needs to call out traffic violence in every form, every time, whether it's spoken, typed, or acted upon. Ma concludes his piece in his always excellent BikePortland.org site by writing, I'm afraid of how we're handling this issue, but I refuse to be afraid of our streets. So many times this past year, we saw the power streets have to unite us. Whose streets? Our streets isn't just a chant. It's an acknowledgement that we all own a piece of the responsibility to keep them safe. We at the Bike Show send the families of those killed our condolences, and to the injured, wishes for complete and speedy recovery. You're listening to the KBRO Bike Show. The show is archived and available at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. Thank you for joining us today. That was Katie Melua singing 9 Million Bicycles. Next, we will hear Michelle Lee Porter's report, how essential employees who cycle to work were affected by the pandemic.
Well, having never owned a car, then I kind of don't know what that's like.
Sean Kelly has been cycling around Portland for over 37 years. Last year, Sean was struck by a car and he was out of work for 3 months. His injuries have made biking the 12 miles between work and home difficult.
The ride home can be really tiring, so if I have the opportunity to take the Max, sometimes I would, but now that the pandemic has been happening, I just ride the whole way.
Sean works as a package handler in North Portland. People like Sean make sure that mail-in goods, such as life-saving medicine and supplies, are delivered and get to people when they need it.
Since I'd broken my hip, it had taken You know, I think the first time I rode home, it took, I rode all the way home, it took 2.5 hours.
TriMet says weekly ridership is down over 63% from February since the governor's stay-at-home order took effect.
I can ride probably about 2 hours before my hip goes, okay, I'm tired, I don't want to do this anymore.
Despite some issues, Sean is taking it in stride.
It kind of forced me to quit being lazy and quit taking the max.
As for the state of driving, the Portland Tribune says that driving fell as low as 4%.
Anything that would encourage people to drive less, I'm all for. But I've been that way my whole life. So this comes along, I'm like, oh, maybe this will change people.
Sean hopes that after all this, PBOT will make streets that are more bikeable, walkable, and enjoyable by all.
The thing that's changed is probably when I actually get on campus, because they have to check your temperature and then you get a mask. And we've got limited exits and entrances. So you have to, usually I come in, there's a side door I can come in and it's really quick. And now I have to carry my bike down a stair. So that's definitely changed.
You just heard from Hugh Potter, a healthcare worker in a major Southwest Portland hospital. Aside from being on the front lines of the COVID-19 health crisis, Hugh also continues to bike to work.
There's a lot of people out walking now, mm-hmm. And so I usually kind of go around them. And I can usually do it in the lane because there's not a lot of traffic, so that's super helpful.
Besides the freedom of having more room on the road, it's also been easier to socially distance.
If they're not maintaining the social distancing, at least they should have masks on. So that should be the new norm, really. I mean, until we have a vaccine.
I want people to have a certain freedom, and I don't believe in that, no. And I don't agree with the statement that if everybody wear a mask, everything disappears.
Perhaps one of the biggest challenges for a healthcare worker, aside from being on the front lines of this pandemic, is invalidation.
I think there's a lot of ignorance, and people just kind of want to believe what they want to believe, instead of looking at the science of things and saying, you know, what does the CDC say? What does the WHO say?
Despite the challenges, Hugh says he is still motivated to keep cycling to work.
We're working on a documentary about the hospital's response to COVID, so that kind of stimulates me to come to work every day to, okay, what's the next new thing that's happening?
Without spoiling too much, Hugh reveals some fascinating details about the documentary.
And talked to the guys working on the vaccine. We talked to the infectious disease folks. One of the guys is doing the study for remdesivir.
So far, we've been talking about Portlanders who have had to continue cycling because they are essential. But what happens when the government deems you as non-essential?
At this point in time, I've been very, very clear. I've asked businesses to take individual responsibility. If they can't offer the takeout version of providing services to their customers, they need to close.
Right now, almost 40 million workers have applied for unemployment since March.
For the last couple of years, I've owned a tour company. Got a couple of partners. We do bike tours, hiking tours, and walking tours.
That was Sarah Gilbert, a longtime Portlander who's been cycling with tourists around town for over 8 years.
Since the crisis began, we haven't really been able to do tours.
Before the pandemic, the bike was essential to her business. But now, in the time of COVID, she's using the bike to make herself essential.
So we've been doing bike service, delivery of coffee, beans, and tea.
Sarah had to adapt, and fast.
In a couple of days, I set up wholesale accounts with a bunch of people, you know, set up a website for part of our website for that.
She says there's more to this than just food delivery.
It was, really busy at first because people were just, craving that connection with their favorite coffee store or just anybody, so a lot of people were really, really excited to have me just come by and deliver coffee to them.
Aside from food delivery, she saw another need that she could fill.
People are wanting to ride their bikes, and it's one of the easiest things to do as a social distancing exercise. So So we started doing lots of service in the store and also mobile bike service, which is really super fun. I love doing it.
There is tension between safety and economic stability. These discussions need to be centered on what frontliners are actually experiencing. We do hope you enjoyed our inaugural episode. My name's Michelle Porter, and as always, keep pushing, keep pedaling, right on PDX.
And that was Michelle Porter's report on essential workers in Portland and their use of bicycles.
Like the Tour de France, like Fred and Ginger when they were doing their dance. To the sound of the river, out on the old bog road, through the gorse and the heather, sure I'm as free as a bird. It helps me remember how good it used to be when I was a king, the bike, the road, and me. I think I'll go for a ride. Every ride is little victories, challenges and trials. You hope the skies won't open when home is many miles. You think you're cruising, your world is floating along. But a fall or a puncture, anything can go wrong. And then you know you're vulnerable, at the mercy of the wind. With every hill you climb, you begin to be a spokesman. With the freedom of the road, you see the Wicklow Mountains, you know you have to go. I think I'll go for a ride. Summer evenings on the road, the cool breeze in my hair, poetry in motion, on two wheels around Kildare. I think I'll go for a ride. There are cycling heroes, each one is my pal. They inspire me when I'm pedaling by the river or canal. Some days I'm Sean Kelly, some days I'm David Byrne, pedaling through Dublin town or in Portland, Oregon. Big Christopher in dreadlocks, Donald Lunny and Alwyn Fuere, cycling through the city, I'm waving for them all there, eh? Get up in your bike. No petrol, no diesel, you'll never get obese. A cadenza in a musical piece, and there is peace, peace of mind, when you ride the frontier between nature and mankind. I think I'll go for a ride. I think I'll go for a ride. Summer evenings on the road, a cool breeze in my head, poetry in motion, on two wheels, round Kildare. I think I'll go for a ride. I think I'll go for a ride. for a ride.
And that was Luca Bloom singing The Ride. You're listening to the KBO Bike Show. Thank you for being with us today. Our guest today is Eric Showell, Program Director of World Bicycle Relief, who will speak to us from his home in Cape Town, South Africa, an organization that since 2005 has been providing bicycles to school children, tree planters, and healthcare workers in several African countries and in Colombia. It is currently providing bicycles to men and women in Zambia, Malawi, and Kenya as they deliver medicines and vaccines. Eric Scholl, good day and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
And where does this find you at this moment?
Currently, I'm based in Cape Town, South Africa. So it's kind of the middle of our summer, considerably better weather than you might have in Portland this time of year.
Before we get to the good work of the World Bicycle Relief, can you please tell us a little bit about your own background and cycling history?
Sure. I grew up just outside of Portland and have lots of memories of riding my bike with my father up to government camp from Sandy, Oregon, and from Portland out to the coast at Cannon Beach. And that really kind of those good memories stood with me as I was considering working with this organization called World Bicycle Relief once I was had moved my family to Zambia in Africa.
What is the history and philosophy of World Bicycle Relief?
It was actually started by one of the founders of SRAM, the bicycle component manufacturer, and his wife. So FK Day and his wife, Leah Misbach Day. And after the tsunami of 2004, they wanted to get involved in some sort of response, you know, but no one was quite sure how could bicycles make a difference. And so they spoke with many organizations in Sri Lanka and learned through World Vision, who did an assessment that bicycles could be really meaningful and helpful post-tsunami, because they had all these fishermen who were making a livelihood out of fishing, and they had been moved 10 kilometers away from the ocean. So they had to get some way of having some way of getting to the ocean to continue their livelihood and you know, provide food for their family. And that's really where it all started. I think in that program, they provided over 23,000 bicycles to World Vision in that response. And when they had further conversations with World Vision about, you know, growing the program, World Vision said, you know, the best place for you to really grow this would be in Zambia, in Africa, because they had their very big health program there. And so they launched the program there, and they were buying bicycles locally. But over time, they found that those bikes really were not meeting the end user's needs. They would fall apart quickly. You couldn't find spare parts enough. And so they needed to have a better solution. And so FK and Leah and Dave Nieswander, who was, I guess, the leader there in Zambia at the time, decided to have their own bicycle design manufactured. And so that's when Buffalo Bicycles was born. And over time, over the next few years, other organizations were really impressed with the quality of this bicycle and the impact it could have on their various health programs, agriculture programs, education programs. And so there was a need for more bicycles than World Bicycle Relief could ever provide. So that's where the idea of having a for-profit entity called Buffalo Bicycles was born, which is wholly owned by World Bicycle Relief. And so there's really kind of two parts to the organization, one that raises funds from places like Europe and the States to provide free bicycles to students typically. And then in each country, we sell the bicycles to organizations, individual farmers, entrepreneurs, dairy people, because it's such a practical tool. And our hope is that as the Buffalo Bicycle gets more profitable, then the profits from each Buffalo Bicycle entity in each country will be able to cover the overhead and bicycles that are supplied by the philanthropic program. So it's really kind of an interesting model it was groundbreaking 10 years ago when it was founded.
And what are some of the projects that the organization is involved with?
I would say traditionally we were involved in education in a program called BEEP, Bicycle Education Empowerment Program. And it was implemented in Asia, in several countries in Africa, in South America, in Colombia. And it really targeted 70% of the bicycles toward girl students and 30% towards boy students, because in many of these countries, the distance to get to school is prohibitive. I mean, it's 5, 10, 15, sometimes 20 kilometers to get to school. And because the distance is so far, often kids drop out. And so it was one way to keep kids in school and make sure that when they got to school, they weren't so exhausted they could focus, they can get involved in after-school activities, they would still be able to do their chores at the household that they would normally do. And so that was how we started. And over the last couple of years, we've learned that really a multi-sectoral approach was important. So we wanted to get involved in agriculture and small business, at like farming, small agriculture farms, as well as healthcare. And so we're calling that mobilized community, where several, you know, hundreds of people are being mobilized with a bicycle in a community in a sustainable way. So we make sure that spare parts are available, that mechanics are trained, and that people are able to buy bicycles, as well as if you meet the criteria, that you would receive a free bicycle, like students or healthcare workers.
And what are the countries that you operate in?
So currently we have operations in Kenya, in Zimbabwe, Malawi, Zambia, and Colombia. We recently opened in Colombia about a year and a half ago.
And there are also projects involving tree planters?
Yes. So in the program, the pilot program we have in Zimbabwe right now around mobilized communities, each one of the recipients of a bicycle will need to plant, I think it's 5 trees over the course of 2 or 3 years. And they'll be responsible for making sure those trees survive, because the area is very arid and dry. And the organization we're implementing with has a strong environmental interest. And so in addition to the bicycle supporting health and agriculture and education, they're also supporting environment. So that would mean like planting these trees. Also, this area is on the border of a national park that has lots of wildlife. And so in these national parks, you know, there's not a fence around the whole thing. It's, you know, it's massive. And so you'll have elephants, lions, cheetahs, hippos roaming outside of the national park area. And obviously, if you're a farmer, you don't want an elephant and these other animals, you know, walking through, ruining your crops, eating your crops. So often there's a real problem with, you know, from those in those villages that are surrounding these national parks. And so a bicycle can help these villages warn other villages on the outskirts of the national park to make sure that the people are ready, that they can avoid all this conflict with the wildlife, which means that there'll be less poaching of the animals, that kind of
thing. And how is it determined who gets the bikes? For example, with school kids, is it based on the distance from school? They're standing in the community. Who decides?
You know, it's a good question. You can imagine when people are making less than $2 a day, the possibility of receiving a bike that's valued at about $175, $180 would be quite a big deal, right? And so we have to have very strict criteria on who will receive a donated bicycle. For students, you're absolutely right. It's about distance. And in fact, distance is a criteria across all the sectors that we work in. You have to be traveling over 3 kilometers one way to your school, to the market, for a healthcare worker, to your clients in the different villages. We also look at the impact a bicycle will have on a child's education, on a healthcare worker's ability to visit more clients. We also look at, so it's distance, it's impact. Oh, we look at gender. So we want 70% of the recipients of these bicycles to be women, just because in most of these societies, it's very patriarchal. And we want to be, I guess, a positive force for change, where women are and girls are seen as very valuable in the community. And we also find that, you know, investing in the women and girls in the community will often have a longer term improvement on the livelihood. So the mothers are less likely to kind of drink away the improved income they get from having a bicycle and not having to spend so much on transport of their tomatoes or onions to the market. So we focus on gender as well.
And in countries like Malawi, where there are many ethnic groups, is there an attempt to make sure that they're distributed among several groups, or how does that work?
So when World Bicycle Relief is considering where to work, we were really looking at three factors. One is, how much need is there in the community? And that typically that is, you know, how far are people having to travel for their basic necessities of life? To school, to the health facility, to the market. And so need is a big factor. But, you know, you can have all kinds of need, but unless the bicycle can address that need in a safe way, then, you know, we don't want to put bikes in a place that aren't going to have an impact. We want to work in an area, like if we were to target Somalia, for example, that would not be a good idea, because you could give bikes and they might just get stolen the next day, and then what happened to the, you know, to the investment? So we look at need, we look at potential impact, but we also look at the sustainability of running the for-profit Buffalo shops in that area. So we want to make sure that when bicycles are donated into a community this year, for the next 5, 10, 15 years, there will be a Buffalo shop selling Buffalo spare parts, having trained local mechanics that can keep those bicycles working, right? We don't want to be what they call kind of dump and run, where you dump the asset in the community and it looks great for some photos for the donors, but, you know, 6, 12, 18 months down the line, the bicycles are broken down, nobody can find the spare parts, nobody knows how to fix the bike. So we're really intentional and invest a lot of energy and effort into making sure the bicycles have a long-term sustainable impact in the communities that we serve.
One of the things that's so clear from your website and also from news stories I read about your organization is the focus on the local population. So it's not, like you said, an organization from the West coming and distributing goods, but actually getting local people to take leadership roles, to fix the bikes, to use them, and that's a really wonderful aspect of your program. Our focus today is about how bicycles are used during this pandemic. What are your bicycles, where are they used during this time?
Yeah, great question, because, you know, traditionally, like I mentioned, we were really focused on education. And during the COVID pandemic, you know, most of these countries, they closed their schools, just like many states in the United States did. And so, you know, kids were not going to school, and there's no online learning, you know, in these rural areas. It doesn't exist. So we quickly pivoted. We talked to other organizations involved in health, and we found that there were a lot of needs with the community healthcare workers that were going to be left unmet if they didn't have some form of reliable, inexpensive transportation. You know, and you can imagine in these countries, these health departments are not well funded. I mean, typically you'll have one healthcare worker instead of the five that would be required kind of per their ratio of nurses to population sort of thing. And so they have, instead of having enough, I guess, trained staff, they have volunteer health workers called community healthcare workers who are doing kind of the basic healthcare services, like keeping people on their antiretroviral drugs or on malaria medicine, making sure that pregnant or lactating mothers are getting the healthcare needs met at the local health center. And so on top of that, which is already kind of a system that's stretched thin, you had this COVID pandemic, which then made everybody afraid to move around and visit the health clinic because they thought, well, maybe I'm going to get sick, right? And so it was really important for healthcare workers to be able to move around to these communities with a bicycle. One of the main reasons was just to get proper information out. These days in the States, misinformation is rampant, right? The same thing that happens in other parts of the world. And so just getting information out to people about, here's what COVID is, here's how it spreads, here's how you can avoid getting infection. And if you do think you're infected, what do you do about it, right? And so getting those messages out kind of village by village by village was a very important way for that to happen. Also, when somebody was suspected of having COVID, what care did they need? So these community healthcare workers were able to reach these villages and teach people, what do I do if I believe I'm infected? And then thirdly, I would say, these healthcare workers were already involved in HIV AIDS programs, malaria programs, tuberculosis programs, And all those still needed to take place, but there was this added burden. And so the bicycle really enabled them to cover more people in a shorter amount of time with, and you know, so that somebody could go from visiting 20 patients a month to over 100 patients a month because they had a bicycle. And I guess the last thing I would just say is, just like you have in the States, fewer people using mass transit, the quote unquote mass transit in these rural areas is typically a minibus full of maybe 14, 15 people. Well, that obviously wasn't going to be conducive to staying COVID-free. So a lot of people would go to their work in the urban areas on a bicycle. So that's another way that the bicycle helped, I think, keep the essential workers doing their important tasks in each one of these contexts.
You're listening to the KBO Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon. And we're happy to have today as our guest, Eric Scholl of World Bicycle Relief, who's speaking to us from South Africa about the wonderful work his organization is doing in many areas, including healthcare. Can you describe maybe a typical day for one of these healthcare workers?
Yeah, so how I've seen that they divide up their work, each one of these health workers has kind of a responsibility for 100 to 200 people in these far-flung villages. So in most of the countries where we work, the communities are not organized around kind of a central hub. It's agrarian society. So it's all about the land that you have to grow food. And so people and villages keep getting farther and farther away from each other. So you can imagine it's difficult to make sure that they'll have access to proper healthcare. So what happens is the healthcare worker needs to travel to them in their villages. And so they will, in the morning, travel to the health center, get whatever they need from the health center, medicines, instructions, and then travel out to these far-flung villages, which can be 10, 15, 20 kilometers away, and encourage them to stay on their antiretroviral AIDS medication or whatever the tasks are that they need to do. And it's also important that these people are often, this is not their only job, right? They're volunteers. They usually will get around $60 a month in compensation. So that is not enough to kind of put food on the table for their families. And so they're also subsistence farmers. So they're doing all this work kind of as a volunteer on top of just trying to grow their own food and their own farms and provide for their own family and their children's school fees. So the bicycle really makes it possible for one, for them to provide for their own family, but also to meet the needs of their fellow community members. And what we found in places like Zimbabwe, which have been significantly hit with economic crises, as well as so many other crises recently, that when we target the healthcare workers, let's say there's in a community, there's 20 healthcare workers that are actually walking and going from village to village. And if we come in and say, okay, here's a bicycle for you to help you do your job, within a year, there will be 20 more community healthcare workers, which are totally needed. But before they had a bicycle, it was kind of a hopeless exercise. They just didn't have the energy, the wherewithal to do the job. So they didn't have the tools they needed to do the job. So a bicycle is seen as a really critical tool, a practical, appropriate technology that's been around for hundreds of years, but it's now being made available in a reliable trend, in a reliable way, in many of these communities.
For those of our listeners who might not be that familiar with Malawi, can you tell us a little bit about that country and how has COVID impacted it?
Yeah, so in many places that we're working, we're actually starting to come on the second wave, which is really starting to close down some of these economies. You know, and these countries aren't sitting on an ability like we are in the States, where the government is, you know, doing checks to, you know, help people keep some income coming in. So it's very difficult to do a complete lockdown when a significant portion of the population are subsistence farmers. What does that even mean? And so what's happened is often the schools are shut down. It's very difficult to get into a hospital. The healthcare system is overwhelmed because there are so many people. They don't have enough ventilators. The resources are stretched. And when they lock down an economy, then fewer taxes are being generated and everything kind of grinds to a halt. And so in Zimbabwe, they're at their second complete lockdown. You can't even leave your house unless it's to buy groceries or like go to a health facility. In some of these other places, they delayed the start of school, but they're still allowing people to go to work because, you know, for them, it's a if I don't work, I don't eat. So it's a very different kind of situation in some of these places, like Malawi or Kenya or Zambia.
And it seems also that now that there is a vaccine, that the wealthy Western countries are the ones that have a majority of the doses. It hasn't been distributed equally so far, adding to the problem, of course. As far as on a more cheerful note, I could ask you about the bicycle itself. So it's called a Buffalo Bicycle, and what's unique about it?
Yeah, great question, you know, because bikes have been around forever. And if you go to Africa, anywhere in Africa, you're going to see bikes everywhere. So what makes the Buffalo unique is it's really designed with the end user in mind. I think a lot of the bikes, we call them bicycle-shaped objects, these ones that were already in the market when we started. And they were typically really poor quality. And you could tell if somebody bought one of these bikes, the first thing that they did before they would start to use it would be to reinforce it with steel rods. So there'd be like rods from the handlebars down to the front wheel that would support the fork. There'd be a carrier on the back that they could use to carry goods. They would reinforce the seat and the many parts of the frame with steel, which would make it incredibly heavy, but they would have to do that so that it wouldn't be breaking under the weight of their heavy loads. And so the Buffalo Bicycle is designed to carry over loads of over 100 kilograms on the back carrier rack. We're currently on the 17th version of the bicycle, so every year one or two improvement comes out, better rims, better front brakes. We're currently working on a multi-gear system in the hub, the rear hub, just so there can be two gears for people to go up hills more easily. So important things like a sealed ball bearing in the pedals, in the bottom bracket, in the steering column, makes it really a reliable bicycle. So I remember we interviewed a woman healthcare worker in Malawi, and she got on the Buffalo Bicycle, and she said, I feel like I'm royalty because this is such a nice bike. I feel honored to be doing my service to the community on such a nice bicycle. So you know, it's not a lightweight bicycle, but it is a rugged bicycle that's appropriate in their context, where if they need to fix it as a bicycle taxi, they can weld onto it, you know, some little handlebars for the person on the back or foot pegs or something like that. So also, you'll find that the Buffalo has such a good reputation for quality. We've made our spare parts so they fit on other types of bicycles. And so you'll find that somebody kind of Frankensteining another bicycle, where they'll start by putting on our wheels and hubs because those are so valuable. And then they might put on our seat or saddle because it's really comfortable and does well under the hot African sun. And so over time, piece by piece, they'll end up with mostly a Buffalo Bicycle until they buy the frame, and then they've got, you know, the whole Buffalo Bicycle. And it's amazing. You'll come across these bicycles that are still working after 10 years, and people are saying, I've never had anything like it. I maintain it on a regular basis, and it just keeps going unlike any other bicycle we've ever seen. And that's really important, because if the other bicycles that are out there take so much maintenance, I think it's actually helping them stay poor. Because they get a bicycle at a really low entry-level cost, but then it starts to fall apart and they have to put so much money into maintaining it, it's really not the right tool for their household and their family. And so I feel really proud to be working with World Bicycle Relief, who has designed the Buffalo Bicycle, to actually help the people get out of poverty.
And is it practical to have a trailer attached, or would that be too difficult with the road situation?
Absolutely not. It actually has happened. We've had aftermarket metal builders who will build, they call them like ambulance trailers. And so it'll be a two-wheeled kind of trailer that's made with our wheels, because they're the strongest wheels out there. And they'll build some sort of frame, and they'll hook it to the Buffalo frame, and they'll pull people from these far villages to the healthcare facility using that as almost like a rural ambulance. And so that happens quite a bit as well.
We are talking with Eric Scholl of World Bicycle Relief, and our time is almost up. So two quick questions. One is, what is next for the organization and for you personally? Where do you see World Bicycle Relief, let's say, in 10, 20 years?
Yeah, great questions. Well, our latest thing is called Mobilize Communities, which we're really excited about, where it doesn't just focus on education, but it focuses on education, health, livelihoods, as well as the environment. So we want those four kind of sectors to be, I guess, improved over the long term in a community. And we're working initially in two districts in each of our focus countries. And we need to learn how to make it so that the right people receive a donated bicycle, but then other people, if they have the means, they can purchase the bicycle. And we really want to understand what impact does this have on healthcare? What impact does it have on people's income for their families? What impact does it have on education for girls and for boys and for those in the community that are actually trying to help their communities move forward? And so as far as the organization, I see us moving into a few new countries, perhaps in Latin America, where there's a huge bicycle culture, and other countries in sub-Saharan Africa, like Uganda, Rwanda, perhaps in West Africa, where there's real potential to kind of meet those three criteria of need, of impact, as well as sustainability.
How can our listeners help?
Well, that's a great question. I would go on to worldbicyclerelief.org and see about the different ways of getting involved. They can make a simple donation. You can also get in to raise funds for an event that you're going to ride or run or race. You can influence other people towards getting involved as well. So those are some of the most practical ways, I think.
We have been speaking with Eric Scholl of World Bicycle Relief, who kindly spoke to us from South Africa, where he and the organization are doing fantastic work with bicycles in many areas, including healthcare. Thank you so much, Eric, for your good work, and all the best.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We have been speaking with Eric Scholl, Program Director of the World Bicycle Relief, who spoke to us from his home in Cape Town, South Africa. For those wishing to help this wonderful organization with its work, building and providing bicycles to tree planters, school children, and medical workers, please check the website at worldbicyclerelief.org. Next up is Michelle E. Porter's report, How Bike Businesses Adapted to the Challenge of Staying Afloat in Our Bike Town During COVID.
In this new normal, statewide lockdowns were put in place to stop the spread of the virus. Activity was mostly limited to what was essential. Meanwhile, driving was down and transit was either unavailable or too risky. All these, plus the void left by gyms, bars, and other ways to exercise and blow off steam, gave rise to a sort of bike renaissance.
Back now with a so-called bike spike. Bike shops all across the Portland metro area tell me they're busier than usual.
As a result, bike shops have been doing gangbusters.
I'm finding out how the bike community acclimates to the new normal. In what ways do they continue to serve cyclists, essential workers, and the community in general? I've talked with three local bike organizations, the Street Trust, Community Cycling Center, and River City Bicycles, to find out. The bike boom has posed a number of challenges for bike organizations. For starters, while the pandemic has made huge demand for bicycles, it has also made a big dent in supply, following the shutdown of factories in Asia, COVID-19's epicenter.
Much like we saw at the front end of this pandemic with toilet paper, bicycles are kind of falling in a similar awareness and demand.
That was Ryan Barrett with River City Bicycles.
So a lot of times our conversations with customers are, just give me anything in this size. I don't care what color, so.
Aside from factory shutdowns, U.S. trade relations are apparently also to blame.
Last year's tariffs kind of created this perfect storm.
That was Gwen Kuhn with Community Cycling Center.
Doing more repairs because we can't sell new bikes and nobody can get new bikes. You know, like people come by and they're like, I've been to 5 bike shops today. Do you have any bikes? You know, like it's sort of that level.
Something I'd also like to note is, you know, when it comes to parts, our buyer actually has an endangered parts list that he's been keeping updated with parts that, you know, week to week it changes.
That was Cole Lalomia with Community Cycling Center. Dealing with growing demand and lean supply also means doubling down on customer service.
So sometimes orders come into the web store and that item just sold on the sales floor. So then it's an opportunity for us to help them find a substitute.
Apart from supply and demand issues, events also took a heavy blow.
The event that was hit is the Bike More Challenge. So that's our largest encouragement event. We typically have 12,000 participants from more than 800 companies.
That was Jillian Detweiler with the Street Trust.
We decided to delay the challenge a month, but we have seen enrollment decline.
Organizations like the Street Trust rely on their engagement with the community. Not being able to educate and advocate the way they used to adds a hurdle to listening and responding to communities' needs.
We would want to be out at farmers markets and street fairs and, you know, doing tabling associated with the Bike More Challenge. Those are not activities that we're able to do right now.
This health crisis has been challenging for everyone. In the case of bike organizations, the biggest challenge is coming up with ways to continue supporting safe transportation while also being safe themselves.
Our store isn't really set up to have safe distancing, so we've made the call to close the showrooms to customers.
But what do we do with challenges? Well, we meet them head on. And that's exactly what essential businesses like bike shops do to adapt.
We are able to have separate workstations, so we're able to distance from ourselves.
Like with every other business, masks and cleaning supplies are now staples in conducting business safely.
How we intake service bicycles, we intake those on the outside of the building, and we wash and disinfect the bikes before service is done.
Another way of adapting is moving a lot of what would have been face-to-face interactions and try-before-you-buy transactions to the internet.
We're basically personalized shoppers, and then we'll place it in bins by the front door. So we kind of have a new structure inside the building.
Meanwhile, the Street Trust has had to continue their work in bike advocacy remotely.
Effective immediately, all large gatherings in the state of Oregon, over 250 people, will be canceled for 4 weeks until April 8th.
This year's Active Transportation Summit was supposed to happen in mere days after the governor's announcement. Jillian and her team have had to adapt quickly.
Had to research computer programs and connect with all of our presenters to offer that program online. So that was an adventure for us.
But it's not all about business and engagement. The pandemic has affected vulnerable communities the most. For some already accessing local food pantries, Cole says it isn't always easy or safe for them to do so.
Staff that work in schools teaching STEM education have all shifted what they do every day to providing food deliveries once a week.
They have also been offering free bike repairs to essential workers.
So our staff who teach bike safety education have been delivering meals from Portland Public School food distribution sites.
Aside from the shift to food delivery, they've been giving away all the bikes they have to folks who can't afford it. Surviving the pandemic doesn't just mean remaining untouched by the disease or keeping the economy afloat. It means reflection.
Everything just is constantly in flux, constantly in question, so we're all still focused on the same thing, which is just figuring out where the need is and how we can meet it safely.
It means finally focusing on what keeps us safe.
So the more people on bikes, the more people reaching for bikes and riding bikes right now is going to show Portland city officials, hey, we're serious. we are a bike town, continue to invest in safer streets.
And ultimately, it means getting through this together, leaving no one behind.
That was Michele Porter's report on the state of cycling in Portland and how COVID has affected bike stores, bike organization, and bicyclists, as well as the creative responses. Thank you, Michele, for this report. We're looking forward to having future reports. Will the bicycle boom that we heard about today continue once the pandemic is defeated? Will those who started riding during the past year continue? Will cities keep the bicycle-friendly modification to streets that they have adopted? Or will the car again regain those spaces? It is up to us, bicycle groups and individual cyclists, to ensure that this tremendous growth in bicycle use continues. We will end with a reminder of the previous pandemic, the 1918 to 1920 Spanish flu, that infected 500 million people, about a quarter of the world's population at the time, killing anywhere from 17 million to 50 million, and possibly as high as 100 million. During that plague, the Dunlop Tire Company placed ads that showed a man on a bicycle and claimed, "If the influenza fiend has had its grip on you, let your bicycle help you to throw it off. Get out into the fresh air whenever you can and ride gently along. The clean, sweet air on the road is far healthier than the stuffy atmosphere inside the tram, the bus, or the train." That was the Dunlop Tire Company in 1918. You have been listening to The Bike Show, brought to you from KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. All our shows are archived and available at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. My name is Alon Robb. My co-hosts are April Streeter and Tori Bortman. I would like to thank our guest, Eric Showell of World Bicycle Relief, and Michele Lee Porter for her report. Thank you for listening today to our show. Safe and joyful rides.
Listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.